We are already a decentralized nation,
yeah,
but we are not united.
Exactly.
Nothing is uniting Venezuelans.
Yeah.
Nothing. And at this, and while that's happening, I want to emphasize this, guys, from my heart. I'm sitting here right now from Caracas, talking to a dude from Lebanon, talking to a dude from Iran, talking to a dude that comes from Iran, but it's living in Austria now. And we are decentralized, and we do have something that unites us, and it's Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so we have to emphasize that, because in the end, you see, it's not about hope, it's about loss.
Thank you. How are you all doing? You know, as the central banks, especially now the European Central Bank, is preparing into, you know, high gear, into, you know, transitioning into creating these, you know, the total panopticon, total surveillance tool with their CBDC, central bank digital currency, or digital euro, as they call it. So, and, you know, and I just read recently the, and we're going to talk about this in this very special episode with Alessandro Cesare from Venezuela, Zia Assad from Iran, Marcel Yunes from Lebanon, and Rajashi Maitra from India. We all have, you know, our commonalities in our you know countries, whether we're, you know, we're born in there or our, you know, root countries, with its, you know, oppressive regimes or inflation, hyperinflation, censorship, sanctions, embargoes, I mean, suffering, pain. So we all, you know, unite, it's a vision, a really strong vision, and really, true love connects us. So I want to, you know, quote out of this, you know, beautiful newsletter, this last newsletter of Marty Bent, issue number 840, with the title, "Some Industry Participants Are Enemies of Bitcoin," subtitle, "This is total anathema to the ethos of Bitcoin and goes against everything Satoshi set out to accomplish when he launched Bitcoin in 2009. Now, I want to, you know, just read one excerpt of this paragraph. It says, the industry leaders, as the market has developed and services have been built on top of Bitcoin, the dark world run by the international banking system has slowly creeped into Bitcoin. The industry leaders who have profited immensely off the Bitcoin network are now getting greedy, creating regulatory moats and hindering the total potential of Bitcoin. If these assholes are successful, they will inevitably find themselves in the spot we talked about yesterday, preventing individuals from sending Bitcoin from these regulated service providers to personal wallets that do not collect or share the data that this working group wants to share with each other. They will inevitably bifurcate the network if we don't destroy these idiotic anti-competition regulations forced on us by an unelected supranational organization that is as ineffective as a condom with a gaping hole in the tip." You should just read this, you know, beautiful, you know, really in plain language that just, you know, nails it, what we're about to encounter. And this is why we need to, you know, create new structures and really, you know, unite and bundle all the resources, the knowledge, the comprehension, our vision, and really, yeah, work towards that, you know, freedom-seeking vision we have. So, without further ado, we're gonna just love this discussion, this talk, where we share our thoughts, our visions, our perspectives, and let me know your questions. And please like it, share, retweet it, follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, YouTube, subscribe to my channel, to my podcast platforms, and let me know what you think. Let me know your questions. My email address is hello@thetotalconnector.com, and hope you're going to enjoy this. Thanks so much. Right. Welcome to the Total Bitcoin Podcast Show. My name is Keyvan Davani, the Total Connector. Thanks so much, guys, for coming on my show. I think you guys need no introduction because you've built up, you know, a huge reputation with all the work. I mean, I don't want to really pat your shoulders or blow up some smoke in your ass, but you've done a really great job to each and every one of you. You know, starting with Marcel or Marco. Can I call you Marcel?
it's whatever you like.
Sounds more poetic.
Both is good.
Yeah. mean, you built like really a huge community. I mean, until, you know, since the last time we talked to one another, but, you know, maybe you can just give a brief overview. And then Alessandro, you're just the most passionate and most, you know, super driving force in Venezuela with CoinSpree and all your projects up and running. Raj, I mean, you're really amazing. I think that my impression is that you are sort of autodidactically taught yourself programming coding, but maybe you can comment a little bit on that. And Zia, I mean, you're more than prominent. You've been quoted so many times and always, you know, mentioned by Alex Gladstein and by so many people now. Andreas Antonopoulos, I even heard him talk about you. I mean, where he started crying. I mean, it's just really touching. So guys, maybe for those listeners who don't know much about you, or have never, but which I doubt, but could you still, you know, starting with Marco or Marcel, give a brief introduction about yourself?
Well, basically, my name is Marcel, and believe it or not, I'm a pharmacist. I have like really nothing to do with economy or anything. So I popped my orange pill, I think like almost 2 years ago, and I was a shitcoiner, honestly, before that, you know, how it is. With 2007, 2008, but I got over it. It was good. And I'm actually the owner or the leader, let's say, or of Bitcoin du Liban, which is the first educational portal about Bitcoin in Lebanon. That's in brief.
Thanks. All right. Alessandro.
Yeah. Thank you, Kivan. Pleased to meet all of you guys. Peace from here, Caracas, Venezuela, and passion as well. I mean, yeah, look, I started with my own, like, I swallowed my first, like, my Bitcoin pill and started going down my Bitcoin rabbit hole about 7 years ago. Wow. So that's quite a lot. Yeah. I'm a millennial, so, and I come from a hyperinflationary environment. So, yeah. I'm the founder of CoinSpree. Basically, CoinSpree was this, my interest in institutionalizing and founding my own Bitcoin business, because I saw a couple of friends doing the same thing. And a couple of friends just were coming to me, like, wanting to launch their own OTC desks or Bitcoin exchanges or Bitcoin mining farms or Bitcoin consulting firms. So it was pretty much booming. And this was in 2016 before I left for China. And then after 2017, the whole environment has changed due to El Petro and the cryptocurrency regulations introduced by the government. So yeah, I'm inside a hectic environment.
Thanks. I said, Raj.
Hey guys, yeah, nice meeting all of you. You guys are my, like, I'm a very big fan of you guys, like all the works you have been doing. And to give a brief introduction, I don't exactly, I'm not very sure how to describe myself. I found Bitcoin around October 2017. So I'm very latecomer. And the reason I got into this was basically money. I had some few cash around, did some Ripple things, and it was good. December 2017, nice times. But then, I started looking into Bitcoin like in more depth, and I'm from background, I'm a structural engineer, so I'm not from technical background. So these all things were very new to me. But the thing I liked about Bitcoin is like the kind of problem that it was solving. And so I started learning to code just to see how this thing works and at the deeper level. And I've been doing this for the last 3 years, and this lockdown and coronavirus came as a blessing in disguise for me, because I got a lot of time to build up on my skills and stuff. So yeah, that's what I've been doing in all of 2020. And currently I am making a small transitions from my fiat job to Bitcoin development full-time. I'm working part-time with our RGB team with building their product in LNPPP and all these nice stuff that's going to happen over there. So yeah, I'm planning to be more involved in the space, because this is how we are changing the world. So it's amazing. It's amazing to finally be here and talk with you guys. Yeah. So really looking forward.
Great. See ya. What's up with you?
Hey guys, so I'm Zia. I haven't done much businesses in this space, but I've been like in Bitcoin businesses, like tourism and like Bitcoin mining stuff. And I've been doing research for the last like 3 or 4 years in Bitcoin. So I got into Bitcoin somehow late 2016, early 2017. So I've been pretty active in the space in Iran. I was also actually the lightning torch holder here in Iran. So if you remember the lightning torch thing, yeah. So, and well, I live in Tehran. We live in Iran. Iran is experiencing a severe case of inflation and censorship. So once I got into Bitcoin, like living in Iran was my clue to get into Bitcoin and stay into Bitcoin and believe in Bitcoin. So that could be a brief introduction for me.
Right. Well, welcome to the show, guys. You know, it's not random that I wanted to have you all guys, you know, on one, you know, one episode, not just randomly, because I see, I don't want to sound like Martin Luther King, but I have a dream, you know, it's like, I have a dream, man. I have a dream. And I think the, you know, it always depends on the strength, on the degree of the strength of the intention. I always say, I don't want to, you know, sound philosophical or anything or esoteric, but, the intention behind this whole thing is that we have some, you know, I come from Iran, Zio comes from Iran, Raj from India, Marcel from Lebanon, and Alessandro Cesare from Venezuela. So, we have more or less, you know, commonalities or, you know, commonly fucked up conditions, which we can, you know, summarize. And I'm just, you know, had this vision or thought, like, what can we learn from one another? How can we create or accelerate some and, you know, build with one another, create with one another, learn from one another, educate one another, and really structurally create something, you know? And I mean, it's just crazy times. And I just, you know, read Marty Bent's newsletter today. I mean, the war has really started. And everybody, you know, who hasn't looked into the article yet, you know, all my listeners should do that. It's the issue number 840. It says some industry participants are enemies of Bitcoin. And just want to, you know, quote some of the articles here. It says here, what this working group is really working to create is a regulatory moat that makes it as hard as possible for new entrants to enter the market, because the more regulation that is catered to means more compliance costs for the upstarts looking to provide better services to the free market. You know, and I got to ask myself, everybody asks me, like, who the fuck are these people, these unelected people for whatever financial action task force? Who are these people? Unelected, you know, is this, you know, I mean, what is the intention behind this whole agenda, and why are they, you know, is this really about like being forced to comply, or is this like what is the intention behind this? And then, you know, this is geopolitical and macroeconomically, there's so much shit going on. And the European Central Bank is literally like preparing the first phases for, you know, introducing central bank digital currency, the digital euro, which they want to, you know, patent or whatever. And so it's, you know, they're preparing the total surveillance tool, at least in the European Union and globally, I mean, generally speaking. Let me just start, I mean, with you, Alexander, because I just listened recently to one of your great interviews on Bitcoin Magazine. What's the impression? What is going on? I mean, is the rope tightening more and more, or do we need like to, is this the time, you know, to get together and you know, and it creates, you know, what should I call it? Synergies, you know?
Okay, so the whole thing about Bitcoin, I see it as financial inclusion, right? And of course, there will be people from the global banking and finance sector that will not want that to happen. I mean, look, it's like we already know that 99% of money globally is digital, but only 1% of global credits is issued online, right? While 40% of global transactions are done and carried out with dollars. So the US banking system specifically is a huge part and a huge deal for financial inclusion globally. But I said this on Bitcoin Magazine. Unfortunately, it does force you to exchange your local currency and eventually travel abroad, go to the US and open up your own US bank account there. And eventually, if you get hacked or something happens with your account and it gets blocked, you will have to go once again to the United States. And so you're basically doomed that way. You're doomed. And now, thanks to Bitcoin, you're seeing countries that are economically depressed, just like Venezuela, transacting over $400 million at a random webpage that a couple of dudes from Finland introduced in 2011. And it was, and it's a WordPress-based website. And it's almost doing like $1 billion in volume inside Venezuela. Meanwhile, the Venezuelan banking system is completely detached from the world, completely detached from the SWIFT banking system. And you can receive money coming from abroad, and you can send money outside of the country. And the bridge that is enabling that, the only bridge that is actually enabling us to move money inside and outside the country, is Bitcoin. It's only Bitcoin. And so I don't know if you guys saw a recent article from Cointelegraph, actually. It was launched yesterday, saying that there was this special dude from the United States tracking Maduro's digital asset transactions, and saying that the regime is using cryptocurrencies to move their money around inside and outside the country after U.S. sanctions came all the way to the regime, right? Like, started forcing them to seek alternative methods. And of course, there's only one alternative method if it's not the traditional banking system, and it's called Bitcoin. And so, I mean, if you read it, you can read it from Chain Analysis reports, right? Venezuela sometimes has the biggest peer-to-peer volume globally, sometimes bigger than Russia. And so, of course, like Jamie Dimon from JP Morgan Chase will not be very supportive towards this alternative method in which he will have to deal with the Chinese Communist Party transacting in Bitcoin, Chinese informal OTC Telegram groups inside Latam, Chinese mining farms inside Iran and Venezuela and Peru, right, and Paraguay. And at the same time, they don't want to know that Maduro is being able to have billions of dollars in digital assets and deal with that, right? Because it's all structured in a way, the legacy system, that it's financially exclusive, not inclusive. And the global banking system is completely overregulated, guys. It's like, it's literally impossible for my generation to start building your own bank. It's impossible, right? And so the only way that we can actually, if you're an entrepreneur and you want to build your own financial products and financial services or whatever, the best way that you will find is Bitcoin. And so Bitcoin is literally open gateways for like building a new part and reinventing a part of the legacy system. And past generations don't want that to happen. I mean, does Jamie Dimon know how to code? Does Jamie Dimon know anything about a GitHub repository? Does he know how to clone a GitHub repository?
I remember
it's evolution, baby.
Yeah,
it's
evolution. I remember, Alessandro, you said something like the GitHub repository is like the strongest force at this moment, you know, in society or something like that in the last century, right?
I mean, it's already more relevant than a commercial register from any jurisdiction, even if it's Switzerland or whatever. It's more relevant. And you don't have the bounty of 20,000 Swiss francs or 50,000 Swiss francs or whatever. I mean, so, yeah.
Yeah, it's awesome. Thanks for the insight. Marcel, let's talk about Lebanon.
Yeah, I'll tell you something. I noticed like Alessandro is talking about entrepreneurship and building new applications and building a financial system, let's say in Venezuela. If I want to compare that to Lebanon, our estimated volume of Bitcoin transactions in 1 month is $1 million only. So we feel, if I want to compare myself, we are like the very, very infancy of a Bitcoin community and growing volume inside of Lebanon. It's incomparable where you guys are, and we're just starting to be. Of course, in the Lebanese system, banking system, you cannot use PayPal or any other payment services. So actually onboarding on the Bitcoin, it's really, really being difficult. I don't know how those things you guys overcame with the time, but in Lebanon, it's really hard to find Bitcoin right now. It's all done P2P. And the banking, of course, doesn't help at all.
It's really impressive, Marcel, that you've built up a huge Bitcoin community. Since the last
time. Since the last time we spoke, I think we had like 100 people, and it wasn't really a Bitcoin community, but then I sneakily transferred it and made it a big Bitcoin community. But now officially we have over 450 active users, and my website is gaining some traffic. We're doing some advertisements, and we're trying to do some marketing for Bitcoin all over the social media. So it's gaining some momentum. People are asking questions. Some people are trying to get more information from me on Bitcoin. And it's working, but people are still shy. People still don't understand. And as I said once before, we don't have enough of pain yet. We are not there yet.
Right. Raj, in India, how many people are there? 1.3 or 1.4 billion people?
Yeah, that's about right. It's a massive population, but I think what Marcel has said, Marco, I'm gonna say your name as Marcel because that's what everybody's using. So what he's saying, like, situation is kind of like Lebanon because we are not there yet. The pain is not there. Mm-hmm. It's true that INR is going down in terms of US dollar every 2 to 5% every year, but it's still not there yet. So what we have in India right now, there is a huge uptick in the blockchain space. So I am seeing a lot of encouragement in the blockchain and the token and all these kind of sorts. But there are no real Bitcoin initiatives or like Bitcoin innovation happening from India that I can see a lot. We have a Bitcoin group in Telegram for Indians and maybe many other peoples, which crosses around 200 members. And the rest of the stuffs are mostly blockchains. And I want to come back to that point of the travel rules. What I see in that article and that Tatoshi wallet that they have proposed. So basically, if you look at the wallet, it's basically a wallet design that breaks all the possible wallet design guidelines and should not, you have to, you, things that you should not do in a wallet into that. So it's basically a wallet that's an example of how not to design a Bitcoin wallet. And they're doing it because they want to comply with the regulations. And I can relate that with the blockchain space, as I'm seeing, like, there are a lot of interest in the blockchain space to comply with this kind of regulations. And we have to be sure that these are coming. So these were predictable, these were supposed to happen, and these are going to come. And we are not going to allure our user towards better privacy and individual freedom by higher user interface or better UX design, because they are going to make shit ton of user interface in that wallet. It's going to be so easy that it will blow people's mind away, like how easy using cryptocurrency by using that wallet. So there's not much way to fight against it. It's going to happen. It's going to take its natural course. And what I'm hopeful about is I think it's not going to work. It's not going to work because it's going to break some fundamental security principles of how you should custody Bitcoin and how you should use a Bitcoin wallet. Because once they will start gathering this kind of data, the map between your KYC identity and the amount of Bitcoin you have, this data is going to leak. So either they're going to have two ways. Either they're going to have it custody on their self in some institutions or in some banking system somewhere, so that will create a honeypot, or it will be some kind of non-custodial mechanism where there will be a public database of individuals with their identity, phone numbers, and addresses, and the amount of Bitcoin they have. So it creates this huge kind of security pressure on individual users. So we are going to see a lot of security mishaps if these kind of things get adoption. So that's one thing good that is working for us. Another thing that I think we need to work, and it's about the Bitcoin and the developer community to work together, is to break the heuristics of chain analysis. Because chain analysis is the thing that is powering all these shenanigans that is happening on top of it. And the chain analysis uses some kind of heuristics, and heuristics uses assumptions. So one very effective way to break this kind of trend and they break this kind of movement is to break those assumptions of chain analysis. And I think that's what PayJoin, CoinJoin, and CoinSwap protocols are doing. So I think that's the kind of way that we are going to make better inclusive financial system. And basically what Alessandro said, this is why they are doing it. They are trying to make our exclusionary financial system. They are trying to mimic the existing financial system on top of this new car. And if you can extend the automobile analogy of Andreas Antonopoulos, it's like basically this wallet is what happens when you say like, okay, let's exchange this V12 engine with 12 horses and maintain our horse carriage.
I love it.
Our horse carriage industry, right? That's what they're trying to do. And it's not going to work because V12 engines are better than horses and the market will slowly force towards it. And the regulators, like they did in automobile, they are going to build the new roads. They are going to build the traffic signaling system. And the regulators just going to have to catch up because now because of Bitcoin market has the way to bypass this kind of shenanigans. And it's actually not possible to implement all these enforcements globally because every nation, every population and every jurisdiction have their own need. So it's theoretically impossible to meet all these needs together so the entire world can come into this kind of gated system. Whenever you create some kind of gated system, there will be always someone who will benefit from staying out of the gate, and people will do that because now the option is open. So that's my take on it. Yeah.
Awesome.
Yeah, I want to comment a little bit about KYC, non-KYC, and I mean, it's never been so, has never entered so much my consciousness, about the real dangers and risk from every, tangent you can think of. Zia, why don't we conclude, with the introduction with you? Zia, can you hear us?
Sorry, I didn't catch that. What was that?
Yeah, go ahead. Why don't you introduce yourself? Or tell us a little bit about Iran.
Well, actually, I wanted to, since I talked a lot about Iran in the recent weeks, so I just wanted to somehow give an update on the situation. So it's the current situation. So it overlaps. So we're still experiencing crackdowns on miners here in Iran. There's somehow, like the government is saying that we're giving permits for miners, but the permits are redundant somehow, that they're useless somehow, because you need some other permits which are not actually existing yet. So with the cost of energy here in Iran, and the inflation situation, so people are really, really interested in mining, because like you can't do good with just having an ordinary job or something, so you can somehow support yourself by mining. And like big miners, they see it as a very good investment opportunity, so people are gonna do it, and people are doing it actually. So but the permit situations and the legal situation is like forcing somehow is like making the situation easier for the government to crack down on miners without any kind of criticism or anything. So they say that you're smuggling some like these devices or something in Iran. And so this is basically the situation with miners. We're still experiencing crackdowns on miners for like now about like 2 years actually. And I know a lot of people who lost like big investments somehow. Some people were jailed actually because of mining in Iran. So I know like foreign investors in Iran who flew away and just like they just left their investment here and just took off so that they won't be prosecuted or something. Yeah, this
so
was
similar to Venezuela. Yeah, so similar, man, like identical.
Like Alessandro, I was actually listening to your interview on Bitcoin Magazine. Like a really good job, actually. You've done a really job there.
Yep.
And I know that we're very similar. I was actually really into the Reddit on like Venezuela Reddit Reddit on the subreddit page. So because I was like expecting, and this is my like theory, that we're going to become more and more like Venezuela. So I'm gonna I need to know how is the situation in Venezuela, so I would be prepared here. So Bitcoin can help with that too. Yeah. So the next thing that I wanted to say was about exchanges. It's actually a different situation with exchanges. So exchanges are getting more and more volume in Iran actually. So there are nowadays we have much more professional teams in the space comparing to a few years ago. And we have like bigger exchanges, better exchanges now. And you could like easily provide Bitcoin. Like a few years ago, like in 2017, like when we had a price volatility or anything, so exchanges would like just shut down and they won't like deal with you. But now you have always, you have the options, and you, other than exchanges, there are a lot of local people, Telegram groups, people who can, you can work with and buy Bitcoin from. But the legal situation of exchanges is actually somehow getting risky, since we're having more and more users in the space, and it's still a gray area. So there are some contradictory statements regarding the regulatory situation. So it's not actually statements, it's mostly rumors. But my guess would be that they're going to crack down on exchanges sometime soon. Mm-hmm. And if they do it like this, they're going to do it just to somehow over-regulate it later. Regulate mm-hmm. more, like make permits for exchanges and stuff. And like, maybe this is their way, like the government's way to enter the Bitcoin space in the future. Because we see this, like the government is always doing this in Iran, in any industry. So they crack down on it, somehow over-regulate it. And then the people who are closer to the government can get somehow permits and stuff to do this thing, and like people would
are you talking about Venezuela?
I think we have this common between all the countries. There's always someone in power that takes over whatever business is happening. I have a quick question for you, Zia. Can you buy using your bank through those exchanges?
It's the main method.
So it's not like only P2P like in Lebanon, because in Lebanon, there's no way we can use a banking system even previously to buy any Bitcoin. You cannot connect to any exchange and send your money over unless you try to do P2P, which is not the point.
Is that KYC? Or is it like a traditional, like in the sense of we understand, like, you know, not like traditional KYC exchange, or is it different from exchange?
Let's say it's just like it's somehow similar to Kraken or something like that. So it's actually very, very liquid and stuff. So you could mm-hmm. just get it easily and use it easily and do KYC and stuff. But there are peer-to-peer options too. And if you want to sell Bitcoin, it's going to be much easier for you, because we have a lot of banking fraud. So if you want to buy Bitcoin, they're gonna KYC the hell out of you. Oh. So they're gonna ask anything about, like, you need to provide documents for everything. So but the other side, or the other way, if you want to sell Bitcoin, they're not gonna ask you for anything. They tell you, give me your bank account number, I'm gonna send you the money.
So they're dumping fiat.
It's like KYC for them, not KYC for us.
Yeah, exactly. So,
What I have to say about what Zia just said is that, based on my experience, you are actually evolving the same way, in the same way that the cryptocurrency environment and space evolved in Venezuela. So first, like, everybody could mine, you could mine freely, there was no problem. Then, like, not directly the government, but like the military ruled by the government as well, started cracking down on huge mining operations, and that's why I got out of Bitcoin mining in 2015. I had one of the biggest Bitcoin mines in Venezuela, which was founded in 2013. I actually founded that with the CEO of Eldorado.io. He's a friend of mine, a dude, a Venezuelan badass that knows Adam Beck as well, and knows Andreas Antonopoulos. He's been to the Crypto Valley and Latam, La Bitconf in Latam. And it was called Lion Mining Cave. But now, it's just like CEO was saying, you need a permit, a mining license from the government. This was introduced last week, together with the newly created decentralized stock market in Venezuela.
When you talk about permit, do you mean like, does that include like a price for corruption? Like, can we talk openly about this? Like,
if you're mining and you have not disclosed your mining operations with the regulator in Venezuela, Sunacrip, you will get burned, man. They're going to fine you like $3,000 all the way up to $15,000. Oh, so okay. I mention this because I understand that Iran's regime is sanctioned, right? Just like Venezuela's. And so after they started trying to build their own cryptocurrency and their own exchanges, their own institutionalized volume, then the United States continued cracking on that. But what the US will not be able to do is say, like, this Bitcoin mining farm is sanctioned, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And there is no KYC on that. And those are newly created coins. So nobody knows where those coins are coming from. And so I think, no, I don't think, I know it's like that. I know it's because that's like the most private way for them to gain exposure to Bitcoin. And then they started allowing other people, entrepreneurs, whatever, businessmen, to build exchanges or peer-to-peer exchanges, whatever, OTCs, to have a clean and decent volume, right? Non-government related, to mix it up with the government volume, which is coming from Bitcoin mining. You need it. And so it's the same thing that the Venezuelan government did. They said, like, okay, this is a small ecosystem that started growing by itself organically. How can we like put our foot inside the ecosystem, control a part of it, and not tear it apart? Basically, the Venezuelan government tried to crack down on local Bitcoins. When they saw that was impossible, they just started using local Bitcoins themselves.
So
you can fight them, join them.
So if I want to compare this to what happens in Iran with like the permit situation, is actually somehow much more worse. It's like if you get a permit, you are now entitled to use an electricity rate, which is actually defined only for mining. Mm-hmm. So there is mm-hmm. like electricity rates or electricity tariffs in Iran, like four or five different plans for industrial uses and like home use or anything. We have now a new tariff for only mining, and it is like about like nine times the usual thing. So that's gonna make it non-profitable to mine, actually. And at the same time, if you don't do this permit thing and you don't like acquire this tariff and then don't pay it, if they find you, they're gonna take your equipment away from you. So let's say that your equipment is worth $100,000. They're gonna take the $100,000 worth of equipment, and then they're gonna fine you three times the value of that. So you're gonna lose about like $400,000 here, and you're gonna be fined, and somehow so if you run away, they're gonna come and take you and jail you. So because that amount of money is a lot in here in Iran, so most people can't afford that.
Zia, let me ask you. I know I asked you that once, but comparing like Venezuelan and the price of electricity, like, is that like, wasn't that somewhere between 4 or 5 cents per kilowatt hour or even less? I mean, Alessandro, do you know like the average rate?
It's actually not official because the electricity industry and electricity utilities are all controlled by the government in Venezuela. But it has been picking up. It has been picking up, and it's happening the same thing like with cryptocurrency, Bitcoin miners. Eventually they start like monitoring your electricity consume and usage. And so if they notice that you're mining, they're just going to, your bill is going to come, it's going to continue to increase. Yeah.
Zia, thanks for that. Alessandro, the nuclear industry, nuclear technology, I know is very advanced in Iran. Now, couldn't we say that, you know, actually Iran has super excessive, like, now besides the oil and gas reserves they have, I think I want to talk about that because, you know, also alluding to Marty Bent, who is this, you know, who started his business with other partners, American Allen, what is it called, mining or something. Wouldn't there be like more than sufficient electricity, like power, just to mine in Iran?
Well, yeah, we actually, So we actually have an excess of energy here in Iran. When we have a lot of energy, which is not usable, which is not transferable, which is not, they are not able to sell it. So they're not using it to mine, and they don't allow people to mine. I said this before, people are doing it, people are mining, but they are not recognizing it, and they're going to they are criminalizing it somehow. So we have an excess of energy. We have a very, very shitty power distribution network, actually. So in the summers, we may experience like cutoffs in electricity, and even in Tehran, we experienced this last year, not this year, but last year. It does not relate to Bitcoin. It is not important. So it's mostly because of the shitty power distribution. But miners don't need to be connected to the grid. The miners like go and build their farms inside power plants. So CHP power plants, gas power plants, and stuff like that. So I know that miners have been doing that. I've seen some infrastructure like... I've visited some of these farms. Like, it was actually on the New York Times article when you saw some of these like mining farms and inside the power plants and stuff. So the thing is that they're not allowing it on I don't know. It's like a stupid reason. I don't know why they're doing it. I guess that they want to enter the scene somehow, and they don't want people to compete with it or something. Yeah, it should be like that. And the price here is like the price of electricity here, like in dollar terms, I should just go and calculate it and tell you about it, because the dollar price is fluctuating every day here in Iran, and fluctuating in like good numbers, like sometimes 5% a day, 20% a day. Yeah.
You're going Venezuela.
Yeah, exactly. So it's very difficult to calculate the price. It's like, it's one, let me see. I'm going to tell you the price later.
Actually, guys, talking about the mining and price of electricity, I just did some math. If we calculated pre-inflation what's happening in Lebanon, for each hour of kilowatt, we pay 30 cents US dollars.
Wow.
So it's like the mining in Lebanon is like impossible. Forget about it. It's done. And yeah.
Well, I can reciprocate the same situation in India. That's why there are no lot of huge mining setup. There were few in the early days, but then the government figured out that they were doing it and they increased the cost of it. So currently it's not profitable to mine in India, and I don't know of anybody who is doing it. But one thing I want to add is, like as Alessandro said, once the government starts figuring out like their best game in this situation is, it's building their own mining farms and controlling it themselves. And that's incentive. I think that's what they're gonna do. And they're gonna first try to control the market by themselves. Then they are will try to think like, okay, should they open it to the public, should they open it to the corporation, or how they're gonna do it. I don't think Indian government is there yet. Many other governments are just in the verge of figuring it out, but this is the natural game that they have to play. So yeah, I think it's coming.
I think the governments will go just like we did in Raj. He mentioned that he followed the money at the beginning of 2008 or 2017, end of it. And the governments will do the same. Just try to tax the hell out of the electricity when it comes to mining. And they'll find incentives and just grow into it. And they just allow it. And they still grow, you know, understand the Bitcoin at the end.
At the very deep down level, governments are just a bunch of people, right? And people are greedy, and they are corrupt. So they will find like Bitcoin is the best thing that they can own. So, but their incentive is much higher than us. So I think like many governments, many people, many central banks are already started to doing it, and we just don't know about it. And suddenly one day somebody is going to like disclose it publicly, and then we're going to see the rush or something like that might happen.
I think this is going to be like, I see this as a self-incentivized Trojan horse. because let me know. Okay, let me, because I was just thinking, you know, we've got this, I mean, I know Zia, you're doing it wrong, but I'm going to say it openly. It's, you know, we've got this theocratic religious regime. I don't even know where it's coming from, but anyway, so it's sort of a communism where the power is like concentrated at the top, you know, with all the Ayatollahs and Mullahs and whatever. So I don't even know where the Islam come from in Iran, but anyway, that's another question. We have so much gas reserves, oil, you know, what if, you know, Zia, it's just theoretically, like if you had a property somewhere in Iran and you found like, you know, gas reserves and, you know, you could like flare it, vent it or whatever, and you could, you know, call up Marty Bent or, I don't know, Steve Barber of Upstream Data, whatever it's called, wouldn't that be like a huge, like win-win situation for everybody, you know, for the government, you know, taxation, you tax the business, you everybody wins. Is that something like a viable strategy we can come up with?
Oh, I don't know, man, because like the government here is very fragmented and every part of the government here decides somehow on their own. And like they have a common goal, and the common goal is somehow not to interrupt the grand narrative of being like somehow hostile to some certain countries like the US, Israel, and yeah. Countries like that. So if you're not interrupting that narrative with the government, so you're somehow free to do yours, free to use your privileges to do stuff here. So like in such a, like it's not a pyramid thing when you consider that someone is in the top and everyone is following that top member or something. It's like somehow floating or somehow. It's very difficult to grasp what they're intending. So I know that there are parts of the government which are very willing to mine Bitcoin and which are very positive on Bitcoin, but there are parts in the government which are much more powerful. And these parts are doing the crackdowns, and I don't know what's their strategy. So I guess it's going to be like this. They're going to enter the space. It's inevitable. So they're going to do it one day. But if they do it, it's not that they would let the people to do mining. So if they want it for themselves only.
Yeah. I recently finished a course that I was doing in Coursera from the London Business School with Professor Julian Birkinshaw. Excellent dude. Has a couple of articles in Harvard as well, Harvard Business Review. I love this sentence and I just can't keep it out of my mind. It just keeps coming back. It's he said at a point of the course, like, government regulations are created to slow things as fast as possible from happening.
that's a really that's good perfect. One.
And so, yeah, that's a harsh reality, right? But in the end, what I do think is like, who has the real knowledge? Who has the entrepreneurial passion? Who is waking up every day trying to build on top of this and not cut its feet, okay? It's us, guys, it's us. Exactly. We have the knowledge. And so in a way, it's very important, like for example, with Marcel, with Bulivan, awesome work that you're doing, dude. I mean, if you only have $1 million in volume, whatever, in Lebanon, of course, the first thing that you need to target is education.
That's what I'm doing.
Yeah,
yeah, that's my whole focus. Nothing else. Just introduce money, people to money. What is money? Simplest question you can start with.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I mean, it's an essential part. You're doing the job that Javier Bastardo, a brother from Venezuela with Satoshi in Venezuela, is doing inside Venezuela, basically. And it's so important, man. Raj was saying when he was introducing himself, like, I got late, I got in 2017. And the beautiness of that is you're not late, dude. We're still very early stages in this.
Yeah, yeah. Indeed. That's what the corundum I get all the time. Like, we're just so early, and like, it's hard to imagine how this space will look like in 10 years down the line. And it sometimes blows my mind when I try to extrapolate it.
Yeah. And
it's huge and real.
Yeah. Awesome conversation, guys. Keep it on going.
Yeah, no, Alexander, I remember you mentioned something that was pretty surprising, or it seemed surprising to me. You talked about the remittance services in Venezuela, that they are, mm-hmm. I don't know, did you talk about Western Union or something like that, that they are even starting to, I don't know, building layers. Can you talk about that a little?
And so, you know that Western Union franchises their business as well. So I know a couple of friends that have Western Union franchises at Colombia and Peru. And so they just do, like, they use Bitcoin on the back. They don't tell people, never. They will never tell people. Like, if they have a couple of friends or families that are in Peru and Colombia and want to send money back to Venezuela in Bolivares, our local currency, what are they going to use? It's Bitcoin. Bitcoin. Mm-hmm. Through local Bitcoins. And so they grab Peruvian sols, take them into exchange it for Bitcoin, then for Bitcoin, local Bitcoins, Bitcoins to Bolivares inside any bank account inside the Venezuelan banking system. So that's huge. That's pretty huge. I see that the biggest value for Bitcoin inside Venezuela, it's not payment, it's not hodling, because we are economically depressed, so people cannot save money. 96% of people are living in poverty inside Venezuela. And so it's remittances, man. It's people that are living outside our country, because we are literally like the Jews now. We are a decentralized nation. We are all over the world, man.
Yeah, diaspora. So, yes.
Yeah. And so that Bitcoin swell. And so, yeah, people want to send money back to their families inside Venezuela and allow their family members to pay for things and stuff inside the countries. How do they do that? The only way is Bitcoin. And so that's why I've been a unique advocate inside the Venezuelan banking system, teaching this bunch of bankers why eventually we want to have our own custodian solutions inside the Venezuelan banking and finance sector, not depend on any payment processor from abroad or any exchange. It's like, will Venezolana de Credito, which is a banking institution in Venezuela that has over 120 years in the market, use the custodian solutions of Coinbase for Coinbase to eat all of their, like, all of their structures? No, man. And so, and at the same time, because of how it's been evolving, Bitcoin will be the medium through which the Venezuelan banking and finance sector will reconnect once again with the global economy.
Awesome. Fascinating.
They just don't do it now.
Yeah.
They just don't do it now, like, officially. Mm-hmm. Because they would have to deal with the regulator. And the regulator of digital currencies in Venezuela is sanctioned by the U.S. Treasury.
Yeah, and the key word was regulator. And you mentioned, like, the regulator, because of the lack of knowledge, or they don't understand, you know, they just don't have the comprehension. Now they are, you know, not only trusting you, but they're coming to you now, right? Yeah. I mean, for whatever, yeah, advice or, you know, education. That's great.
And so you see, once again, I'll repeat this and fine emphasize this. Thus, a banker nowadays know how to code? Does a banker nowadays from a Venezuelan banking institution know about Python or know about GitHub or know? No, man. And so it's a generational thing. You do see a lot of usage of and Bitcoin adoption, of course, coming from millennials, Venezuelan millennials. And so they just see it as a cool thing. It's like, yeah, I mean, people know about it inside Venezuela. I have a bunch of friends that have already got into Bitcoin, et cetera. I'm not talking about me personally. I'm just talking about, like, the average millennial Bitcoin experience for a Venezuelan, right?
Alessandra, I had a question for you. So you were talking about remittance, and I wanted to ask you, like, we don't have actually any options for remittance here in Iran, and we never had for many years. We have a system called Hawale. So I don't know if you are somehow familiar with this concept.
Yeah, like, it works in India too.
Yeah, exactly. It's mostly in, like, Islamic and semi-Islamic or something countries. So there are people, like, in the Western, like, countries or something, they take your, like, USD or euros, and they have a person here in Iran, he's going to give you the money. So there's no money transfer here. So they do this, and they're going to take a lot of premium, like 10% or something. They're going to take a big cut.
Sometimes, like ATM, I think, right? Very similar to ATM.
Yeah.
Cool.
So yeah. So I've seen this system like somehow working. Some people use it over the years, like people who want to do remittance and money back home, or send money from home to their students or to their children who are like studying abroad or something. But nowadays, like I'm gonna tell you that the Bitcoin community in Iran had no influence on this matter whatsoever. So I'm seeing people who don't know anything about Bitcoin using Bitcoin actually, because it's much easier, and it's not gonna like cost them that like 10% or something. Somehow, sometimes actually they get more money. They get it because like the price of Bitcoin in Iran maybe like 2 or 3% more than the global rate.
Oh, that's what I'm gonna ask you. Is that the markup, the average markup, like on or above whatever, what do you call it, the market price or spot price? Is that like
2, I don't 2%? Know what it's called, but it's most of the times it's either equal or more. So maybe 2, 3, 4. So back in the days it was like maybe 10 or 15%. Wow. But nowadays it's like most, like if it gets really high, it's maybe 4 or 5%. Mm-hmm. So people like buy Bitcoin, like in Germany, they send the Bitcoin here to their family, and if they like cash it out, it's gonna be more actually. So it's not gonna cost them a premium, and it's much easier because they don't need to trust anyone here like to do this hawala thing for them. And like I'm seeing people doing this, and they know like zero about Bitcoin. Like sometimes, most of the times, they use like something like Kraken or something, like in other countries to get Bitcoin. It's like, and they send it directly from Kraken to their to an exchange here in Iran, and the exchange is gonna pay them. So they're doing it, and it's like it amazes me like how people found out about Bitcoin because of like the low barrier to entry, and the like most of these young people in which are abroad, like are techie and tech savvy or something. So they figure it out, they understand it on their own, they use it even if there's not enough education. So they're gonna do it because it's like it seems organic and natural to do.
Yeah, I was just gonna, you know, talk about, I had this vision like for the film also, what, you know, like give the people not only some hopium, but like the real vision behind Bitcoin. But, you know, I know, Raj, you have to go like in a few minutes, but let me ask you before you go, Raj, I mean, I can't imagine, are there like, there are like more than 1 billion people in India. Do you see or do you know from anybody like the little versions of Michael Saylor, like business people, you know, whatever, macro investors, entrepreneurs that are, you know, storing their whatever you call it, we'll call it treasury reserve or, you know, their cash reserves in Bitcoin, or just ordinary people as a store of value?
Yeah, not yet. We are still in retail, so we don't have institutional adoption at that level yet, because the government intentionally here kind of like clouded the regulation and the framework around it. They tried to force some kind of bans, but this ban proposal never get really implemented in parliament. It just kind of create a FUD and fears and uncertainty in the market. So for now, it's only the retails. But yeah, I want to extend on what Zia said about Hawala. Hawala is like what I know, I'm not very sure about the details, but Hawala in the western side of India is already a closed economy system, and it has been there like that for like last 500, 600 years. So if you think about all the different ways like humanity have figured out the way to reduce the cost of transaction among each other, and when they figure out Bitcoin, it will be like the most easiest thing to do at that front. So it will be like natural game. So exactly.
And after they run their own Bitcoin full node, they're gonna come.
Yeah, they're gonna come in one way or another, but yeah, not there yet, because as I said earlier, the need is not there. We still have a functioning banking system. It still seems like holding on its own. I'm not sure how long it's gonna hold on its own like this, but yeah, it's not at least going to happen. My prediction is not within next 5 years, maybe something later than that, but like the objects in your mirror, like rear mirrors, are closer than they appear. So that might be a case.
Okay. So the need and the pain point is just not there. But yeah, whether one can accelerate this process, that's that's another question.
Yeah, but I also like want to add, like, as we had a conversation the first time I came into your show, like, Indian people have this very strong gut feelings about store of values. Like, they have a huge stores of retail gold, like the biggest store of retail gold in household gold in the world.
Yeah, so, that's true. It's like, isn't that like 10-11% of all like jewelry or whatever gold is?
Yeah, and it's a custom, it's a tradition, and it's something that the bride gets at their wedding, and so they have this intense gut feelings of store of value. Even they don't understand why it works like that, or they never thought about it. It's just a generational knowledge that it has worked. So I think Indian population is very potent to absorb another much better form of store of value than gold. So it's just a matter of time. I'm not much worried about adoption. We have a lot of kings and buildings to do at the infrastructure layer, so that's where I'm trying to focus on my part of the time. So maybe we'll reach there, we'll find all these kind of solutions, and we'll fight it together. We are all in this together, and it's a global fight for freedom. So it's amazing being here with you guys. So I have to leave, I have to join another call. Nice talking with you. Maybe we can do sometimes later also.
It was great. Thanks so much for your insights, man. Hope we can repeat
this
in the future.
Thank you, Raj. Nice meeting you, man.
Nice talking to you all, you guys. Bye.
Bye, Raj.
Bye. Bye.
Nice
Bye,
meeting Raj. You.
Thanks so much.
So actually, we have that tradition here in Iran too. You know about that, Kayvan?
I guess, like, I think all Middle Eastern and Asian countries, they have this thing about the gold. They love gold.
Yeah, they're so obsessed with gold. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, like, so it's now a genius.
So if you look at like the money, what do you call it, lira or something? So this lira thing is somehow a translation for like gold coins or something. So our currencies are named after gold. Sometimes you can see that too.
Guys, I have a question actually, because you were mentioning about premiums in Iran, right? Would you believe that at some point, I think 2 or 3 months ago, when we had shortage of dollars, actually Bitcoin came on a discount. You could have bought like Bitcoin for a 5% discount.
Oh, oh my God. Oh my God. That's
insane.
Yeah. So if anyone has some dollars here, if you have dollars here, just buy on a discount of Bitcoin basically. And the more money you have, cash of course, the more Bitcoin you can have like on discount. That's what happened.
Yeah,
like,
so that's ago. It's interesting you mentioned that, dude, because like, for example, if you want to buy, I don't know how much Coinbase is charging, for example, to buy Bitcoins via their exchange. But I do know, like, for example, Square Cash app charges all the way from potentially 5% to 1.something%, depending on the volume of Bitcoins that you're buying. And so and you're talking about a U.S. app coming from a U.S. based business, which is a public company ran by the owner of Twitter, and he charges you like at a minimum 1.75%, right? But in Venezuela, you have OTCs where you take $1 million in cash, and the premium to buy Bitcoin with cash is only 1%.
Wow. Okay.
And so what does this translate into? The more an economy is getting hyper-Bitcoinized, the more premiums come down because you will have more liquidity providers.
In that case, Lebanon should be hyper-Bitcoinized long time ago with minus 5%. But the case is opposite. The case is totally opposite in Lebanon. I mean, seriously, I'm jealous where you guys, what kind of things you have, because in Lebanon, I mean, I have an internet limit of $15 now, and that's all I can do. And I can even not buy Bitcoin with it. There's no whatsoever exchange that will ever accept a Lebanese bank in order to transfer, do whatever you want, KYC. It's just impossible. Even in Lebanon, we can get proof of residence. We don't really have a number on housing, on houses. So it's really, really difficult for Lebanese people to onboard. It's not that easy. And the system is collapsing, and it's collapsing really, really fast.
Yeah, we've been seeing that on social media, like the riots and stuff.
Yeah, the riots are like less now than before, but the people are silent. This is the crazy part. I mean, we increased our, I mean, we inflated sixfold in this year, in the past 12 months, and people are still not in the street. They're still okay with everything. They don't mind it anyway, and they're not looking for solution. And that's the scary part. It's really terrifying. Yeah,
same thing happened in Venezuela. Mm-hmm. Same thing, man.
I'm really excited to have this talk tomorrow with again with Alessandro Cesera, Richard Myers, Randy Breed of Lachomesh, and Brian Larkin. He's also sort of a techie, I think. I know we're always light years ahead with our visions, but this independence, this technological independence from internet and power grid, I think it's going to change a lot structurally, you know, and open up, you know, vast opportunities. But you know, we'll go deeper into that tomorrow.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but yeah, it's freedom, after all. Yeah. So you just have to dive in and start using it. There's no borders; it's borderless.
Exactly. You know, then we'll live totally. You know, the ethos of censorship resistance, total borderlessness, unconfiscatability. I mean,
if I want to add something about that, so I recently read the what was it called? The virtual communities text. It was like written in 1994 by Tim May. You know Tim May?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, he was one of the founders of the cypherpunks mailing list and stuff. So he was talking about like virtual communities and how they operate and how they transact with each other and live with each other easily on this thing. So, so we could get used to, he was like seeing this in 1994, and he actually wrote down stuff about that, like even in the 80s, 1988, the Crypto Anarchist Manifesto, and he saw this vision, so why wouldn't it happen? I'm seeing people over decades thinking about this, so it's going to be organic, actually. I feel that it's going to be like this.
There's just this trailer released by Jim Epstein. I contacted him actually to join our film group. He did a great introduction, or what do you call it, teaser trailer for his series. I think it's a series, right, on cyberpunk's code or something, cyberpunk's bright code or something. It's really great. So while you're mentioning Tim May, I think I'm sure he's, you know, there's also a lot of mentioning on him. All right, guys, let's want to wrap this up or
we can just wrap it up. And then if you'd like, I could just provide some last insights that I wrote down for the show. These are all information insights coming from EcoAnalytica. EcoAnalytica is basically one of the leading companies inside Venezuela at evaluating and studying the economy inside Venezuela, how it's running, inflation, which payment methods we are using, who's hoarding cash, who's hoarding what. They don't dive into Bitcoin because they don't understand anything about it. but yeah, it's pretty interesting. And I think especially for you, Marcel, that you're in Lebanon and you see inflation is picking up. I have this experience. We are already hyperinflation in Venezuela. And so here it goes. In 2019, only 40% of transactions were done with dollar banknotes inside Venezuela. In 2018, the only things that you would pay for in dollars and that sellers would demand dollars for selling those goods was real estate and cars. Now it's everything. You can pay for everything in dollars. Like the Venezuelan laws and jurisdiction, like regulations, prohibited dollar payments, right? And payments in other fiat currencies. Now it's do whatever you want, man. And you're not, right? And if you're paying cash, you're not paying taxes to the government. But we have this huge problem that 53% of that 60% of transactions is done via cash. And so because we don't have, look at what's happening. Because we don't have an agreement with the U.S. Treasury, we can legally exchange those dollar banknotes for newer banknotes And so you would see crappy banknotes all over the economy, right?
Circular economy.
It's a circular economy. And so now that the US, that the Venezuelan government got sanctioned, they're saying like, okay, we got sanctioned. Let's use the private part of the economy, right? Like not the state owned. And let's start allowing them to cash in on those dollars. So now banks inside Venezuela are being able to open up US dollar accounts, right? Which is weird because you can have dollars inside your bank account and you will be able to start depositing those dollar banknotes inside banks in Venezuela, but you won't be able to make international payments.
Storekeepers for you. That's it. They just keep it for you.
It's only like a way for figuring out how to move more and more and more the circular economy, right? And eventually you will be able to have your debit card from your Venezuelan banking institution and pay with dollars. Because, really, I mean, if you want to buy right now, like, a couple of things and the seller wants to charge $1.50 for that, he can't. Because there won't be any coins to give him back or give you back those 50 cents if you pay him with $2. So it's idiotic. But the interesting thing of this is that 30% of that 60% of transactions, it's done via Zelle, okay? Which is the online payment method for sending and receiving dollars up to $2,000 a day. Using U.S. banking institutions. So you literally have 18% of Venezuelan transactions being carried by a U.S. payment method.
Very valuable insights. Yeah, it's very fascinating. Yeah, the breakdown.
And so this all ended up creating a byproduct economy, which the Venezuelan government did not want it to create, right? And so we are no longer a local currency economy and a believer-based economy. We are a multi-currency economy. We use euros, dollars, mostly dollars, Colombian pesos, Bitcoin, Ethereum.
Anything. Anything but Boulevard.
We were buying gasoline from Iran using gold. Right.
Yeah, I remember. And
then we get the gasoline here, and you can pay for that gasoline using your U.S. debit card. How hypocrite is the system? And so in the end, look, below banking institutions at a global level, regarding regulations, we're seeing fintechs being introduced in the middle between cryptocurrency businesses and banking institutions because we see lots of governments cracking down on cryptocurrency operations, digital asset transactions, etc. And so, like the regulations inside Venezuela for a fintech are, of course, 100 times friendlier than for digital asset companies. And so that is why, and in the end, look, be it Western Union, be it Bancumbre, which is a small fintech with over 900 users that is a commercial ally of Coinspree. And Coinspree helped them to have their own multi-sig setup based on the Caravan protocol, right? With a Trezor Model 1 and a Bitbox from Crypto Security. Now it's cool. They have their own 3 multi-sig setup. They have their treasury coin, not based on Coinbase or Kraken or whatever, because they are scared that eventually Kraken tells them you can have Bitcoins on because you were operating from Venezuela, right? Look at Paxful. Paxful had to leave the country. And so they are all using Bitcoin, but as a back office tool. No, you will not see Bitcoin on their website. You will not see them advertising their digital asset operations and that their business. You will all see them as a multi-currency digital bank or whatever fintech. And that's all happening in Colombia, in Venezuela, in Brazil, in Chile, in Argentina. And it will continue picking up. And I think eventually that will pick up in other parts of the world, not only Latin America. because the monetary debasement is hallucinating. It's fucking hallucinating.
Yeah. Let me just add something to that hallucination that's happening in Lebanon. Actually, in 2016, our M1, which is the money supply for Lebanon, it was 4.5 trillion. But the end of this month, it's going to be around 38 trillion Lebanese lira. So that's like, well, a lot over the past few years.
Oh my God, this is real hyperinflation. Jesus Christ.
No, and so, and look at the US. The US printing like 18
9 trillion. So, yeah, exactly.
Like 22% of global dollars were emitted in 2020.
Yeah, but the only advantage US, it's because the international reserve currency, because like 70-80% whatever global trade is, they can procrastinate, they can just delay this whole process. It's because they have the power of reserve
currency. That's the Milchik
effect. Exactly. Yes, yes.
Milchik effect. And so you have all of this deprecated economies craving for dollars.
Exactly.
Crying for dollars.
This is what people need to understand. Thanks a lot for emphasizing.
That's how they get away with it.
Yeah.
And so it is our task, because we are the perfect educators, guys. It is us. Mm-hmm. It is, we literally have to figure out a way, just like Kivan does, how the hell do we wake up every single day and we use like at least an hour of our time of our daily lives to educate people. And sometimes it'll be only one person.
This is why I want to do the film, Alessandro. Like, how, because this is so fucking essential. Like, everything you're telling, like translating it to visualization in, in Lebanon, in Venezuela, in Iran, in India, with all those people. Like, what? Just 5 minutes of that time, Like, whatever, not a utopian bullshit, but it's like, this is before and this is after with Bitcoin. Uh-huh. This is what your life looks like, all right, on Bitcoin.
No, and literally we have to like emphasize a lot, like this is before, this will be a future, and this is now. Because this is not, this is no future, man. This is now. This is happening now.
This is reality, the matrix. Wake up.
But many people are still in such a denial. It just, you can't break through them.
Yeah.
Really, honestly. I mean, this is nice opium, but come on, you can't convince everyone. They don't see it, what's happening. They don't see the problem. They don't see problem in printing. It's fine. Yeah, it's okay. Let them do it.
I think we still haven't seen in the industry. I mean, we're almost not even an industry yet. We're like a community. Like, could we say that there's a Bitcoin industry in Lebanon? I don't think so. It's more of like a community, right? Yeah. Can we say that we have a Bitcoin industry in Venezuela? I don't think so as well. But we are hyper Bitcoinized already. I'm sure that we are like at a per capita level the most hyper Bitcoinized country in the world. I'm sure of that, man. But we still haven't seen, like, there's still not a Pepsi Cola like ad of Bitcoin. You know what I mean? Like,
this is what we need. Yes.
You know what I mean, man? But
we should do that, actually. This we should is try what we to need. Like organize it. Organize a banners all over Venezuela, India, Iran, and Venezuela.
Yeah, seriously, maybe we should focus on that. Like a commercial.
I mean, like,
a big gold campaign.
I want to emphasize this. I started selling Bitcoin to people as, this new form of money, whatever, the long-term vision. Bitcoin is going to go to $100,000, and that's super cool. But inside Venezuela, at least, what people like being sold is a lifestyle.
Gotcha. Okay.
It's a lifestyle.
What is an average lifestyle, like imagination or visualization of people? Like what? A Lamborghini? It's not. It's definitely not like a Lamborghini, is it?
I mean, dude, if you go on Instagram and you hop on for a couple of minutes, you will see all of these scammers selling training courses. Look at my Lamborghini. I live in the U.S. and I'm rich because I do training, and it's all a bunch of bullshit, right? Yeah. Bitcoin gets infected by those people indirectly, but it gets infected because once I try to approach people, and I've done it successfully, right? Friends and family members and whatever, they all say like, "Oh, Alessandro, I love what you're like. I love the insights that you're providing me for free because I met this guy the other day who was offering me this to be part a member of this WhatsApp group for $250 to learn about trading or whatever. And so, you see, man, we need a Pepsi Cola ad of Bitcoin. Not even Pepsi Cola, because Bitcoin is the Coca Cola of money. It's not Pepsi Cola.
we should discuss that in the next film group session. Seriously, I mean, man.
You know what I mean, Kivan?
It's overdue. Yeah, this is overdue. We had our last session, but we need to, our core team, we need to get together and really just focus on this, because I think it's way too broad right now, the vision for a film production. You know, it's just, if we want to do it, we need to do this perfect. This is why, you know, I'm waiting for, until we know we have a treatment, a raw script, you know, a short trailer, and then, you know, I can give it to people I know in the film industry. But unless, you know, we don't have anything like tangible, like a substantial thing in our hands, they're not going to even think about, co-producing or sponsoring, whatever, crowdfunding it or whatever. Yeah.
I wanted to tell you that yesterday, a dude from Aruba, do you know Aruba, like the Dutch Antille? It's an island that it's very close to Venezuela, right? Mm-hmm. It's a Dutch Antille, and so it's pretty cool. Their economy is very stable. Like, the average wage in Aruba, it's like $2,500, which is a lot for an island. I've been under talks with the Arubian Central Bank since 2017. I've been trying to convince them to have their own custodian solution, etc., for them to add Bitcoin inside the reserves of the Arubian Central Bank. And so up until now, they've only allowed one dude inside all of Aruba to have his like Bitcoin company. It's called Bitcoin Aruba. Mm-hmm. And so I was discussing, he texted me via LinkedIn, and I was discussing with him that I've always had this vision of creating, I wanted to do this in Venezuela. I even said it in Max Kaiser, right? Like a 2021 event for people to see how it's like inside here. I don't know if it will be possible, but that's why I've also been under talks with people from Aruba to see if I'm able to launch like a Bitcoin Caribbean event, like the first Bitcoin Caribbean meetup, dude. Okay. And do
now
it inside.
We're talking. Now we're talking. Party.
And do it inside Aruba, man. And he is so down to the idea. It's like, talk to the people that you know, Alessandro. Tell them that there will be a way. Tell them, I've even talked to ministers, like ministries inside Aruba. Aruba is such a small island. I've been traveling to. I've been to Aruba more than 30 times, man. And so this is why I'm mentioning this. And I do want to be able to like. Make it come true, just because it's so close to Venezuela, man. I mean, you can literally go by boat to Aruba from Venezuela. And and they have a more stable economy being an island than Venezuela, just being tourism-based. So they are perfect for Bitcoin. They're perfect for Bitcoin. Like being tourists, being able to pay hotels in Bitcoin, taxi cabs in Bitcoin.
Oh my God, this is what I call a free private city. This is the direction that I was actually suggesting, you know, like this could be real. This is a free private city, you know, we're circular, like whatever, deflation economics.
Dude,
you know?
look at BitMEX in the island of Seychelles, trillions of dollars in Bitcoin derivatives. What the heck? You see, small jurisdictions, fewer people, easier to get into. And so that's, I mean, like, we have to think like czars, not in a monopolistic way, right? But we have to think strategically how to start getting into the different parts of the world and letting them know, like, you know. Like,
and this is how you attract investors, entrepreneurs, you know, inventors, engineers, you know, people who built the structure from scratch up, you know, like. You know, everything else is obsolete then, you know?
Hey, look at George Soros. George Soros' quantum fund is based not in the US, it's based in Curaçao, which is a neighboring island of Aruba.
Yeah. I've never been there. I just know the liquor in cocktails. Yeah.
so figure it out, man. It's the perfect way.
Stick to that. We gotta talk about that separately. Yeah, yeah. Thanks so much, man. So Marcel.
Yeah.
Final thoughts.
I'm honestly, as I said before, I'm jealous of you guys, and I've learned a lot from you, especially Alessandro, about the things that hopefully are coming into Lebanon. We are going through a really difficult situation, so I mean, wish us luck. This is just the beginning for us.
Great. Thanks so much, Marcel. Zia, are you still here?
Yeah, I'm here. I was listening to you. Sorry. So I was at the same time I saw like something cooking up on Twitter about like chain analysis stuff and how they're like, tainted coins and stuff. So I wanted actually to somehow emphasize this point too in this talk that we need more like privacy take on Bitcoin. We need more like something like coin joins and stuff like that on Bitcoin. It's really, really important for us. Like, so I live in a sanctioned country, so I know how it feels to like be like rejected or to like get confiscated, like the money, your money gets confiscated or something when you like send it to a business. Or so I want to just emphasize this, that we need this more than others maybe. And we may not do any criminal activity, but maybe we may be, our coins may be considered tainted. So we should just talk about this later on a different episode or something. Like we actually need this.
Yeah. And you know, this is the reason, you know, I brought us together, because I truly not only believe, I trust in the power of connecting, of cooperation, and like bundling the essence, you know, of what are we trying to achieve here? What's the end goal? What's the intention behind it? You know, like, let's just focus on and bring everybody in, you know, who is, you know, from whatever, from Michael Saylor to the, you know, to the techie, to the coder programmer, to the entrepreneurs, to the podcasters. I think there's a strategy behind it, but you know, I'm just a nobody, you know, I don't want to understate myself, but I think there's a way to that. I had sort of an enlightenment last night, but we need to really concentrate this power, you know, of knowledge, comprehension, energy, and really create the synergy that we all, you know, dreaming about, but it just needs to be manifested into, you know, whatever, like physical, digital reality.
Yeah, I just want to close it up, guys, from my behalf. Talking again, like, about what Zaya said regarding teammates' vision of, like, digital communities, right? This is already a digital community. Look at us. Yeah. Look at us, man. We are already fulfilling that vision. And so, for example, in the Satoshi in Venezuela Telegram group, I've said it a bunch of times. Like, I trust more buying Bitcoin from people from this group than buying Bitcoin from a local Bitcoin trader, right? And so, in a way, although it's like we have to understand regulations, but if we are really wise and we are really understanding the power that's behind all of this and what we are all collectively creating globally, because we are already like a collective wisdom cloud of knowledge, we have to figure out a way how to jumpstart and jump past government regulations by ourselves, because Bitcoin will not do it by itself. It will be done by the community and its advocates. And so eventually I would love to see us like go down a road where Marcel can receive Bitcoins and cash out of those Bitcoins for Lebanese liras or whatever without going through an exchange, because that's a real peer-to-peer thing. And that's a real vision of Bitcoin, man.
Exactly. Literally. Yes.
And so, and ultimately what I would like to say is this, perhaps I value it more than other peers inside the community because of what I've gone through, right? Because of what I've gone through regarding the Venezuelan, the destruction of the Venezuelan economy. Because since Maduro took power in 2014, the economy has contracted by over 80%. And so again, 80% economic contraction, 96% people living in poverty, over 1,200,000 Venezuelans living in Colombia next door, over 1 million Venezuelans living in Panama, almost over 1 million Venezuelans living in Europe, spread it all over Europe.
Yeah. And so with the Iranians, I mean, look at the Iranians. It's everywhere. Like,
we are already a decentralized nation.
Yeah.
But we are not united.
Exactly.
Nothing is uniting Venezuelans.
Yeah.
Nothing. And at this, and while that's happening, I want to emphasize this, guys, from my heart. I'm sitting here right now from Caracas, talking to a dude from Lebanon, talking to a dude from Iran, talking to a dude that comes from Iran, but it's living in Austria now. And we are decentralized, and we do have something that unites us, and it's Bitcoin.
Yeah.
And so we have to emphasize, that, because in the end, you see, it's not about hope. It's about love.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. Yeah. With all its glory and you know, and really total comprehension, but it's beyond words. So, you know, every time, you know, I want to jack up my emotions, I just need to listen to Alessandro Cesera. he's my really, man, you're I mean, it's beyond words sometimes. I mean, it's not being bullish, all that crap. There's a much, much, you know, bigger vision behind Bitcoin, and I know we are almost there. It's in plain sight, you know. All right.
Yeah.
Well, guys, thanks so much again. And we need, really, my wish and desire is that we repeat this on a, you know, regular sessions once in a while. And yeah, I hope all our listeners and viewers, you know, take the best out of this and start, yeah, implementing.
Exactly.
Thank you very much, brothers. It was so cool meeting you. Literally, I'm so pumped up right now.
All right, guys. Thank you so much. And I'll see you. Yeah.
Yeah. Great. So I wanted to say, I feel what Alessandro is like feeling right now. So, yeah, definitely. So it's like, oh man. So as he said, someone from Venezuela, I've been following Venezuela, and as someone who is an Iranian who is living abroad for many years now, and someone from an Arabic country. Actually, I'm an Arab too, so I talk Arabic too. So I see that, like, we're somehow connected, even if we don't want to, like, even if we didn't try to connect ourselves. This is Bitcoin. We have more similarities than we think, and like, Bitcoin is connecting us. So yeah, I'm really pumped up too.
It's like gravity that's pulling us all together in one spot.
Yeah, man.
Yeah. Gravitation. Exactly.
Yeah. Sometimes I feel stressed because I said, like, I have this huge burden that I need to fulfill, this responsibility, right?
It feels like a mission, to be honest with you.
That's life, man.
Chosen mission. Yeah.
Well, I'm on a rush, dudes. I'm going to have a cup of coffee and continue working. Thank you so much. I loved it. I love being part of this show and this episode. Keep on.
Love it too, man. Really enjoyed this. Talk to you soon. All right?
All right, bye-bye. Guys.
Peace, brothers.
Thank you. See you.
Bye, guys. Thank you.
All right. Bye-bye.
Ciao. What do you guys think? It wasn't that mind-blowing. I knew this is going to be a really super passionate, you know, super educational and enriching episode together, you know, with Alessandro Cesera, Zia Sadr from Iran, Alessandro Cesera from Venezuela again, Rajar Shimaitre from India, and Marcel Younes from Lebanon. It really, a strong vision unites us, a strong essence. So if you have any, you know, let me know what you think. And it really would really be helpful if any of you can contribute, you know, to this vision that we talked about, to the creation and production of a trailer, a commercial, even of a documentary. So if you want to join us, let me know, DM me or write me an email at hello@thetotalconnector.com. We are, you know, with very well-known Bitcoiners in this group, and I want to really do this together with all of us. And if you want to, you know, contribute in any shape or form, would it be, doesn't even need to be like monetary resources, but if you, like, you know, are in the film business, or you know, you're an expert in graphics, sound, film production, post-production, or you know people in the film business who, you know, who not only believe, you know, some in some kind of hopium, but really understand, comprehend what we are trying to achieve here. What's the intention behind this film project? Let me know. And so we can, it's all about love, right? It's about love, it's about freedom, and it's about evolution. And so I was really, fascinated and amazed at the depth of this discussion, this talk. So let me know your ideas, your input, your inspirations. My email address, hello@thetotalconnect.com. If you love this episode, please write me a positive review, a personal on any podcast platform. Please subscribe, retweet, share this with your friends, colleagues, family, whoever you know, because this is about not only monetary evolution, this is about, you know, human evolution, scientific, technological evolution, social evolution. It's about a structural evolution that we are about to see. So as the old world, you know, this old toxic, control obsessed, corrupted criminal world is, you know, trying to, you know, tighten the rope around, you know, humanity's neck. We are literally creating a totally new structure, which is beyond description, beyond imagination, let alone beyond, you know, comprehension. So thank you so much again for your, you know, for your faith, for all your input, for all your inspirations, for your support, for your help. And together we can create a totally new, you know, civilization, human civilization, where we can thrive, blossom, and, you know, experience a really fundamental shift on any level, in any dimension you can think of. So Bitcoin is about love. Thank you so much.